today on Against the Grain. In what ways do beauty and ideals of beauty affect women and girls? Which ideas from which feminist traditions can be drawn upon to examine and critique the beauty industry, broadly defined? I'm CS. Meeta Rani Jha discusses her book, The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Beauty is a valued, sought-after asset in today's culture. The question we'll take up today is why? What's behind women's and girls' desire to be beautiful, to try to look like women in advertisements? And what does this say about this society's political, economic, and cultural values, structures, and priorities? We'll also explore how beauty plays out among women of color, many of whom fall under the sway of an ideal of white femininity, with all that means for what women do to their hair and their skin and their bodies, and for their body image and self-esteem. Much of Meeta Rani Jha's research has focused on the beauty pageant phenomenon, on skin lightening and other appearance-changing practices, and on social movements that constitute an anti-racist challenge to the dominant white beauty standard. In her book, The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body, Meeta also writes about feminist history and about the waves or forms that feminist thought has taken, especially since the 1960s. Meeta Rani Jha is a feminist sociologist, an anti-racist activist, and a lecturer in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at UC Berkeley. When Meeta joined me recently in studio, I asked her about something she writes about in her book, which is the crowning of a South Asian American, a woman named Nina Davalori, as Miss America 2014.
There was a lot of coverage of how that was a sign of kind of racial progress and this idea of multicultural America. People were kind of very excited about it because she also had very dark skin. Some people were actually very angry that it wasn't, someone white who had won. And there was quite a lot of Twitter conversations on, Islamophobic comments about her being a Muslim, her being South Asian, and so on.
So one of the chapters in this book, The Global Beauty Industry, is about this woman, Nina Davalori, winning the 2014 Miss America Beauty Pageant. But in fact, before you get into that in this chapter, you lay out a history of feminism, of feminist ideas, of strains of feminist thought, some of the key books and ideas that mark an evolution, you might say, of feminist consciousness. Why did you find that necessary? Why is it important to have kind of a grounding in feminism and feminist ideas and feminist history in order to understand things like what the Miss America Beauty Pageant means and why the crowning of a South Asian American as Miss America is significant?
I think that the first protest that had happened at a Miss America pageant was a feminist protest. And for the second wave feminism to become popular, beauty or the idea of feminine beauty was kind of used as a vehicle to kind of popularize ideas of feminism. So I think it was really important that, in 2013, 2014, ideas around, the racial changes and nation making that was going on was very much connected to ideas of feminism that was going on in 1968. So, for example, the protest which happened in 1968 in September, the idea was that women's bodies were being sexually objectified. And so the debate was always, for example, to do with second wave feminism was, should we actually, wear certain clothes? Should we actually perform our femininity? But in this instance, when you think about 2013 and 14, actually that wasn't being discussed at all. So to go back to kind of 1968 and why beauty was like the site of struggle for feminism, that's because at that time, femininity was seen as opposite of feminism. And that wasn't the case in by the time we come to 2014. So I was kind of interested in charting the way feminisms had come about, different kinds of formations of feminisms, and how that idea of femininity versus feminism had changed quite drastically. You know, femininity as a kind of production of patriarchy wasn't being discussed at all.
So you mentioned second wave feminism. I mean, first wave feminism, as you point out in this book, focused on the right to vote from the 18th to the early 20th centuries. Big question, but which feminisms then fall within the category of second wave feminism?
Just to kind of start off by saying that the idea of waves to characterize feminism, it's not a fixed thing. You can have, second wave ideas in much later feminisms to do with third wave or fourth wave. So basically, the wave idea is to kind of make it simpler. So, you know, as you said, first wave. Second wave feminism, some scholars have argued they kind of starts at this time. It's very much a formation around 1960s, civil rights kind of mobilizations, anti-Vietnam War. And, a lot of young women going to college and universities are kind of thinking about feminism in the sense that the middle classes had access to education. So it comes about at this kind of juncture. So second wave feminism, people have argued, kind of becomes popular from the 1968 Miss America pageant. But then we kind of go through ideas of, sexual liberation to do with kind of, access to employment, access to education was already happening for certain groups of women, right? And very much about individual rights as well, right to your own body, right? So the whole kind of the anti-abortion and abortion kind of conflicts that happened around that time and to do with, women to own their bodies kind of idea. So second wave feminism was very much kind of associated with that. Just to say that obviously it was also, liberal feminism kind of became associated with some of the aspects of rights with second wave feminism, but it was kind of a combination of, radical feminism, Marxist and socialist feminism as well. So New York radical women who actually organized the Miss America protest were, a group of women who were, radical feminist as well as Marxist feminists, and some probably believed in liberal feminism too.
That's Mita Rani Jha. She's author of The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body. So Marxist feminist analysis, what are the basic features of that analysis? What do Marxist feminists like to highlight?
Obviously, I think it's to do with labor hierarchies. And it goes back to the kind of the first kind of sexual class difference, which is women not only reproducing, to do with sexual reproduction, but also the kind of idea of child rearing. So Sulamith Firestone kind of talks about, child bearing and child rearing. And she actually, in her amazing article in 1970, The Dialectic of Sex, she kind of argues that sexual kind of exploitation is the first class hierarchy. So women as a sexual class and the way they get exploited. So I suppose Marxist feminists would focus on, the labor hierarchies that are assigned to sexually different humans, women, right? I would also say that even though obviously women have access to the employment sphere, the gender gap, gender pay gap, and many other kinds of hierarchies to do with, when women get pregnant and they lose out on their career, it keeps continuing. So Marxist feminism is a very, very kind of strong movement within feminism.
And how do liberal feminists differ from radical feminists? What is radical feminism do that liberal feminism perhaps either shies away from or tends to ignore or avoid?
I think that liberal feminism works within the kind of, you know, liberal, democratic, capitalist market kind of polity, right? The structure. Whereas the, I would think that Marxist feminism would actually ask for the social transformation of the whole political structure and the economic, obviously, structure. So the economic and political and culture are interconnected in that way. I think that the one main difference I would highlight with liberal feminism is that it often becomes individualistic. So feminism is a collective process. And at some point, when we see the development of liberal feminism, which didn't start out as an individual project, even though obviously within liberalism, individual rights are what we focus on. At some point, the idea of freedom and choice becomes hyper-individualistic, where is that the focus on groups of women who are kind of doing well, they have access to education and employment, and they're kind of going through their career, that the idea that somehow, you know, feminism has succeeded. Now, that's like the new liberal aspect. And then that we come to like the third wave. And it's often it was called post-feminism, which was very much critiqued for this idea of individual feminism and individual kind of empowerment of women, rather than that, you know, we needed to think about labor practices. We needed to think about the system that was actually exploiting groups of women and so on.
So is it fair to say that liberal and neoliberal feminism likes to focus or point to individual success stories? You know, here are women who've risen above and who are doing great, and that is the ultimate end result that feminism ought to strive for?
I would say so. I mean, you know, I think the critique of liberal feminism is the idea that, you know, individual freedom, individual choice and success, that became almost fetishized in neoliberal turn, which, you know, late 1970s. And then we see, you know, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher really influenced this neoliberal turn, where the idea that, you know, if you're, it's almost this entrepreneurial kind of spirit, the radical free market ideology, the rolling back of welfare reform, all these things that kind of characterize a neoliberal turn. And in fact, also meant that the kind of feminism that was being practiced in media cultures was often about these successful women, women kind of having the choice to kind of have sexual freedom, you know, going out and dressing up. And commodities and consuming became quite central to it as well. One feminist, Angela McRobbie, looks at Sex in the City, and that becomes kind of like a symbolic aspect of post-feminist media culture. And, you know, some people may argue against that, but the kinds of things where, you know, you've got enough money and you can kind of go out drinking, wearing high heels, but at the same time, you know, it's kind of very conventional format. And so that neoliberal femininity that comes out of that culture was criticized as being post-feminist. And this is in the third wave of feminism. And third wave feminism had many different kinds of feminism. You know, people would say that black feminism actually, as a reaction to some of the second wave ideas, became a lot more predominant in the third wave. Queer feminism kind of came into that picture as well. But, you know, one of the kind of key changes that happened was like media and consumer culture becomes a space where we look for our identity and create our subjectivity. And that's kind of late 1970s, well, around 1980s. And then, you know, it keeps changing. And in 1990s, we have come to this place where post-feminism is kind of quite fashionable, right? It's quite popular. So it's almost like a backlash against second wave feminism, saying, you know, there were like even until, say, 6-7 years ago, where women, young women, would not admit to being a feminist. Now, that's not the case in the fourth wave feminism. So, you know, we've had first wave feminism, voting rights, suffragettes, second wave feminism, a kind of, you know, individual rights, a little bit of, you know, Marxist feminist kind of mobilizations, as well as radical feminism, where, you know, the separatism aspects. Then we have Black feminism coming through as a reaction and actually as a part of second wave formation as well. And then in the third wave, you know, the whole gender and sex distinction is very much kind of, I want to say, exploded, so that the idea that gender and sex are both socially or culturally constructed becomes very popular. Media culture is very, very dominant. And in that aspect, post-feminist ideologies are kind of very common at that time. And the fourth wave feminism, I would say, last 5 years, maybe, where we're thinking about a kind of a rise of a new kind of feminist formation, where women are actually quite comfortable saying they're feminist, young women, this is younger generation, and actually really talking about it on social media kind of platforms as well. So these are the different waves. But as I was saying to you earlier, I think these are just a way to characterize kinds of feminisms. And you could easily have second wave ideas and obviously Marxist ideas and other ideas now in contemporary culture, as well as ideas around neoliberal femininity, are very common.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Mita Rani Jha joins us. She teaches in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at UC Berkeley. For a long time, she was a community organizer working on issues of racial discrimination, low pay, migration, domestic violence, and home working in the UK. And the book we are discussing is her book. It's called The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body. Wow, there's so much I kind of want to follow up with you based on that very rich answer you just gave. But I guess one of them is simply that, you know, one critique that Black feminism and radical feminisms had of second wave feminism, at least the kind of the mainstream liberal feminist strand of second wave feminism, is its privileging of white women and economically privileged women, right?
Yeah, I think that is one of the most common critique. I think that it, like, you know, if you go back to that historical context, a lot of Black women were very active as well. You know, they were active in the civil rights movement. They were active in feminist movements, and as well as the Combahee River Collective actually, you know, started meeting in 1970s. So that is a time of second wave feminism. So I would say that, you know, Black feminists really challenged this idea that this category of woman, you know, and did it actually include Black women, women of color, you know, women from third world. So in kind of spaces where they were organizing for civil rights movement or Black power movement and Black nationalism, and their kind of sexual difference was kind of very much kind of erased in a way, like they were treated like not as people with ideas. But in feminist spaces, their issues were not given, you know, any kind of highlight as well. So they were kind of struggling in these spaces. And a lot of Black feminist writing comes out of the ways women were excluded in these spaces, and that, you know, their voice was not being heard, really. And the issues that mattered to them weren't being discussed at all.
Let's talk about some of these ideas as applied to beauty. Susan Bordo has looked at the impact of advertisements for beauty products. What has she argued?
Susan Bordo is kind of very, very important figure, because she's actually arguing that the beauty industry really uses consumer culture as a space to socialize women into consuming a whole set of objects to try to answer their inadequacies. Obviously, we've kind of thought about patriarchy, but also multinational corporations and how they try to kind of invite, but also in some ways manipulate women's inadequacies to do with their kind of feminine roles.
Right. I mean, cosmetics, for example, some, maybe many women, they use them in order to, I guess, at least as the theory goes, be attractive to men. And that is in service of a patriarchal ideal or a culture based on the fact that that should be a priority.
Yeah, I think that just going back to Susan Bordeaux, that the idea that femininity is a product of patriarchal culture. And so how is femininity being constructed? It's often through bodies, and the bodies in, you know, advertising and images and so on. So, you know, the kinds of cultural norms that women receive, not only through their families, through their communities, but in media socialization, right, is that, you know, you should be very slim, you should be, you know, much lighter skin, your hair should be in a certain way. There's a whole host of things that women are supposed to conform to be ideally acceptable. So that there are kind of standards, beauty standards and norms, and then ideals. And in a media saturated culture, the ideals become very important because you're constantly comparing yourself to these unattainable images, right? Then if we're constantly seeing these figures who are amazingly slim and beautiful and have beautiful teeth and hair, then that's what becomes our norm to do with feminine identity. And I think that's what she's kind of bringing up. And also she's kind of relating it to the whole body dissatisfaction amongst women. There's plenty of research, definitely amongst young women. And it's a constant kind of, you know, it's an everyday practice. It's not just a little bit of grooming, but there are so many products. So for all the different parts of your body, your eyebrows, your eyelashes, your, you know, obviously skin color, your kind of hair products, and it's a whole host of that. So I suppose her kind of contribution is this idea of fashion industrial complex. You know, beauty industry means a whole host of, you know, includes media corporations, it includes kind of fashion and beauty pageant and health industries as well, and how they've kind of brought about any kind of second wave feminist progress that we had. These industries have actually taken women back to a place where they've internalized ideas of, you know, what should be the ideal. And therefore, there's this kind of psychic contradiction that she talks about, is that women are always under self-surveillance, like an internalized governmentality of yourself.
A governmentality. And also, I mean, what is the psychic effect of seeing these ideals in the media that, as you say, are unattainable? I mean, what effect does that have on a girl's or a woman's self-esteem and self-image and body image?
It definitely wreaks havoc, right? You're constantly trying to be accepted by conforming to these kind of ideals. And I think it's much stronger for younger women and younger girls. So you know, we see kind of research into six-year-old girls now kind of thinking about, you know, how do they start dieting? And that's kind of the success of the diet industry. And you know, in our culture, we're kind of immersed in this dieting and beauty and exercise and all sorts of kind of body disciplining. It's a success of a consumer capitalism that it's kind of colonized our kind of insights in that way.
Yeah, and this you've written about this notion of, this emotion of shame and inadequacy that young women feel if they cannot, and they cannot, the vast majority of the time, they cannot live up to this ideal that they see in these magazines or in these advertisements.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think I was in a conference, and one of the speakers said that there are thousands of beauty apps. And the beauty apps are almost like a site of comparison, and, you know, it's to do with a constant comparison that brings about this kind of shame, because you're kind of never fitting in or you're never reaching this kind of ideal. The beauty apps can tell you that they actually are very interesting in that they're almost like a friend. One app, for example, kind of says, you know, your friends aren't going to tell you, but I'll tell you that you're looking, you know, fat, or you're looking this, or you're, you know, whatever's going on, your skin's not looking as good. So it's this kind of shaming is very much part of our cultural surveillance that's going on. And it's being brought about by beauty kind of corporations. Nigerians. And that idea of shaming is, you know, the increase in social disease, the anorexia. Susan Bordo actually talks about this idea of the increase in young women, the anorexia kind of epidemic, because there is so much shaming going on that it's a way of having control over which way your femininity is going to get validated. So the kinds of disciplinary practices that we kind of use every day, like, you know, the whole media interaction apps, becomes a site of, you know, physical and psychic pain. So it kind of tells us something about the consumer culture that we're kind of invested in.
Meeta Rani Jha, author of The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body. We'll take a short break and speak more with Meeta about her book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Meeta Rani Jha joins me. She's a feminist sociologist, an anti-racist activist, and a lecturer in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at UC Berkeley. We've been talking about her book, The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body. Well, ideals of beauty, as you said, can generate pain, psychic pain among girls and young women and other women who feel they have to live up to certain standards propagated in the media. You also, though, do point to some research that shows that beauty practices, that ways in which women work on their beauty, have positive valences, have generate positive emotions for women, both individually and collectively. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think that the, you know, feminist highlighting of beauty kind of as a site of oppression, we've already talked to do with like how second wave feminism actually comes into being or becomes much more popularized. And so I think that, you know, one author who I kind of really liked her work was Maxine Leeds Craig's ideas around beauty. Not only that, obviously it's oppressive, but at the same time, women come together in cultural practices where they're kind of, you know, like doing makeup together. In Maxine Leeds Craig's article, she talks about hair straightening and how that was a site of leisure for, you know, she kind of goes back to 1960s and she looks at how women actually made a little bit of space to kind of do hair straightening with
this
each other.
Black women.
Black women. And in that way, it becomes a space of kind of family, sisterly bonding and pleasure. So I think that idea, the beauty is like, you know, like the idea of femininity being oppressive and beauty as an aspect of patriarchy, that's still there. But at the same time, women aren't stupid. You know, they're not doing this just because, you know, they're being manipulated. And it's also about, you know, in this aspect, most of the women were probably working class Black women who didn't have this space of leisure. And so it allowed this space to bond. But as well as that, you know, the idea of hair straightening and grooming was about a middle class respectability. So that the idea that this thing actually, when you invest in it, it actually allows you a socioeconomic mobility as well. So that's the kind of the advantage and the empowering aspect. So this is where the problem becomes. You know, I talked about post-feminism and how women, by consuming and using different consumer products, are able to feel empowered, right? So it has an empowering aspect. It's, you know, it's to do with emotional connection. And often, you know, we connect to, you know, these amazing feminine icons who we love, who become part of our kind of, you know, imaginary journey. So beauty includes all of this, right? But at the same time, when we think about post-feminism and the idea of empowerment through consumer products, it is also about validating, you know, the cultural norms of beauty. And I think the main problem comes when we think about younger girls. So, you know, in the second chapter, there's a story of Janet where, you know, she kind of says because she has dark skin, and there is a lot of kind of negative comments that are being made in her family, where she just feels like she just wants to die. Right.
And this is because she has darker skin than the rest of her family.
Yeah. So people tell her, like her aunts would say, oh, you're really not going to do that well. And it's because she's supposed to be not beautiful. And that kind of pain that you see, how are we going to get rid of that from the culture that we're in? From all the research and the kinds of products we have, it's often based on a white femininity kind of ideal, right? So women with darker skin can't fit in. Women with disability can't fit in. Women, if they're kind of, you know, from different working class backgrounds, have different accents. And also if, for example, they're doing work that's associated with kind of not delicate kind of femininity, they can't fit in. So it's this exclusion of women who may not be considered beautiful, then they're considered ugly. And, you know, what about, you know, I kind of just was given a book on looking at the idea of ugly. And when the kind of the whole identity of becoming a lesbian is to try to kind of, you know, appropriate this idea of ugly. So then you are not, you know, you're not conforming to heterosexual kind of matrix. So it's this beauty and ugly continuum. And, you know, considering that it's such a intense site of feminine formation and not of masculine formation, right? That women do kind of affiliate to it, attach to these ideas and these ideals and norms. So just to go back to Maxine Leeds Craig's example, so she actually argues that actually it's organizing around beauty that brought about the whole Black is Beautiful cultural campaign. And so it was this anti-racist challenge to Eurocentric knowledge. And it was about cultural challenge. So then beauty is also doing that work, right? It is that you challenge sexism and racism and ableism through kind of saying, look, I am as good and I can have other ideas of femininity and beauty as well.
Yeah, you spend quite a bit of this book talking about Black is Beautiful and this notion of women who are African-American feeling pride in, you know, whatever they have in a natural sort of way, the afro, the way their hair is naturally, the way their skin looks, their facial features, which may not be Anglo-conforming, so to speak. You know, one thing I also want to ask you about, it's another maybe aspect of this discussion and debate about beauty, is this notion of beauty capital. And I think you associate this with the thinker Naomi Wolf, although many other people may have come up with this notion. So beauty as a resource and as something to be exchanged for other things. Can you describe what's going on here?
Yeah. So yeah, it is actually, I think Naomi Wolf is associated with this idea. It is her idea around thinking through different kinds of beauty ideologies. And she kind of argues that beauty is a currency. So, you know, you kind of invest in it to see what else you get out of it. So it's an exchange. And in that way, it's a form of cultural capital. But actually, you know, there is a lot of research which says that actually, you know, it allows you access to economic capital as well. So, you know, it's like an embodied thing that you have or that you can develop through different technologies to be able to access employment markets, marriage markets, and possibly social networks as well. So I think there are two economists who actually looked into this, and they found that the appearance matters as much as race and gender when we're thinking about accessing employment and labor markets. The idea is that, you know, if you think about, like, if, for example, you know, you want to be an air hostess, or if you want to be a television presenter, there are very confining rules to your physical appearance, right? What how you should look. And definitely the kind of power that you can have in a sexist, racist society is by shaping your body so that it can kind of compete in that kind of structure as well.
How does this idea of beauty capital apply in your mind to the Miss America beauty pageant, and who wins that pageant, and also what the winner of that pageant gets in return, perhaps, for her, if we could call it, beauty capital?
So I know that Miss America Beauty Pageant kind of now calls itself a scholarship. And so you do get quite a lot of money. I think it's so, the, for example, with the case study of Miss Devildry that we were looking at, she actually argued that she wanted to pay for her medical education. That's why she took part in it. And so that's kind of very, very interesting in that. Obviously, education should be free, but young women would argue, in this case, she's arguing that, oh, you know, she may not have agreed with other aspect of the beauty pageant. I'm not sure if that's what's there, but that she did it so that she could become a doctor. So the kind of whole narrative is of a person who's kind of aspiring and upwardly, you know, it's mobile through education as well as through beauty. So beauty capital in that way kind of, you know, really works in situations, because we're talking about patriarchy here, where what's valued is your appearance and your kind of how you compete with other women in fitting to the ideal, and in that you're actually validated or you're kind of accepted for that more than your actual qualification for the job, so to speak.
That's the voice of Meeta Rani Jha. She is a lecturer in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at UC Berkeley. Formerly a community organizer working on many issues, including racial discrimination and domestic violence in the UK. And her book is The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what's your principal critique of the Miss America Beauty Pageant? Because as you said, I mean, when Nina Davalori won the Miss America Beauty Pageant for 2014, it was applauded by lots of folks, people saying, well, it's progressive and in a racial sense, and this is a victory for racial equality in certain senses, maybe a reflection of the racially progressive policies fought for by social movements since the 1960s. So What disturbs you most, in addition perhaps to this notion of beauty, this investment in beauty as having some kind of return, as seeing being more maybe of a commodity than something in and of itself?
I think that the key thing that disturbs me is that it's a validation of exceptional kind of meritocratic identity, or you know, this institution, even if Miss America pageant has changed, it's changed because of the different social movements that have kind of influenced the way the whole nation has been changing, right? So yeah, you know, they do certain things, basic requirements, right? But I think that what it actually displays on a kind of global stage is this idea that US kind of liberal capitalism is benign, that it actually is very good. This is the way the whole world should be kind of governed in a way. And I think that's what's kind of problematic with any kind of national institution that plays this tokenistic multiculturalism, right? Look, we have diversity, we're pro-feminist. So what's going on is that civil rights kind of discourses of diversity are being appropriated, and feminist kind of ideas, but only slightly, right? So that the image or the publicity is like, look, this is what we're doing. Look how much we're doing. But the actual change is not going on. You know, why are we even having a Miss America pageant? Okay, so we're having it because it's about the economy. It's about the economic regeneration of, you know, it's an institution that actually brings about many different kinds of corporations together who can market their product to a national public. But I think that it's not the actual reality of selling us, you know, these products. And in this case, women's bodies, women as the ideal bodies, right? You know, that young girls are supposed to mimic and go through the kind of pain they go through. So that the problematic bit is that there is the commodification of women as cultural objects. That doesn't get highlighted. What gets highlighted is that it's diversity. It's almost feminist somehow, you know, and this is a post-feminist discourse here.
And I want to make sure I ask you about Beyoncé, because she is the focus of part of this chapter in this book. And you write about her being, you know, this global icon and this amazing performer, role model of ideal beauty and Black femininity for many girls and women around the world. You note that her lighter skin and blonde hair says something, at least to you, about how Beyoncé fits in relation to white-oriented beauty standards. Why do you bring up Beyoncé, and what do you make of, for example, her announcement at, I guess it was an MTV Video Music Awards ceremony, that she was a feminist?
I think that Beyoncé is a really important figure for our times. And I think the reason is that you know, as I kind of pointed out, like how these different kind of discourses of feminism, of kind of anti-racism, you know, Black is beautiful campaigns, how they're kind of taken in, appropriated, incorporated by different marketing kind of companies and devices. Anything that's of value to do with social change becomes commodified or incorporated in these programs to sell it back to us. Now, Beyoncé is not a person, right? In this context, she's like a combination of texts that are kind of mobilized. So, for example, you know, she's a producer of these videos. And she is a feminist icon because she says so, right? She might be a kind of feminist that I may not have everything in common with, but, you know, any woman who says, I am a feminist, I think that's the space that's opened up. It might not have been, you know, 1960s, but what's good about that is that that word is not being associated with this ideas of kind of aggressiveness, aggressive women, and that, you know, like women hating men and so on. So there are sort of lots of positive aspects of that. You know, she's been able to take that position of a producer, which is pretty significant for, you know, women in general in musical industry. So I would say that. But at the same time, you know, like her kind of, it's a kind of a neoliberal femininity. So we go back to neoliberal capitalism, the kind of capitalism that rolled back, you know, social welfare. It rolled back and actually wants to roll back any kind of governmental kind of social democratic programs. But it's very much about this idea of entrepreneurship. It's very much about a kind of identity which is about cost and benefit. Right. And this is all of us. We've all internalized it. Right. You know, how are we going to be productive? How do we kind of do this so that we can get to this position of being productive? You know, hardworking, meritocratic, all these words. And unfortunately, that's the kind of subject formation that neoliberal capitalism comes out of. And Beyoncé is very much part of that. You know, like all the stories about her that, look, she can balance, you know, heterosexual marriage and she can be a performer. She can be a producer. She's a global icon. She's sexy. She's beautiful. So all the beauty and sexiness as capital is also being constructed all the time. So, you know, if we think about institutions and the kinds of lack of power that people of color and Black people have had in this country, then I think that it is a success. The kind of feminist aspect, people have argued that, you know, because she performs different kinds of kind of, you know, a class identity, kind of queer performances, so that her audience is what becomes important. So, for example, when I'm teaching this chapter to my students, you know, so many students just love Beyoncé, right? And actually, even my niece, when I was talking to her, and you have to be really careful because, you know, it's a different generation. And it's the kind of, you know, when I was talking about beauty as affect and identification. So it's often this idea of relationship that people have formed, even if she is strengthening ideas of whiteness and beauty, which is very harmful for Black women and women of color to a certain extent. But then she goes and does these other things that where she can kind be, you know, she can be a friend again. So I think it's, again, very contradictory, but she is a sign of the kind of neoliberal capitalism that, you know, is very, very much harming us at the moment.
Meeta Rani Jha, MeetaRaniJha. She teaches in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at UC Berkeley, and her book is The Global Beauty Industry, Colorism, Racism, and the National Body. It's published by Routledge. Meeta, thanks for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me to come in.
And Meeta is now immersed in a new book project, which looks at gender inclusion and exclusion in the Silicon Valley tech industry. That project is a collaboration between Meeta and UC Santa Barbara professor France Windance Twine. We turn now to a Black feminist theorist that Meeta cites in her book, Angela Davis. Back in 1998, Angela Davis gave a talk about her book, Blues, Legacies, and Black Feminism. Here's an excerpt of that talk.
As we think about our relationship to history, and as we continually construct our history, there are certain aspects of that history that are never supposed to be discovered, that are supposed to remain hidden. When we talk about the contributions that poor women, poor Black women made, we're not supposed to acknowledge them as having been agents of history, and certainly not of having played a role in shaping what we might call feminist historical traditions. And so it occurred to me that if I were going to seriously try to look at history from the vantage point of poor women, from the vantage point of working class women, I would have to find some texts that are different from the written texts that we normally use when we do this kind of research. Because the women I was concerned about didn't have access to the institutions that produced those literary texts, perhaps didn't have the skills required to produce them in the way that we are accustomed to receiving them. But of course, during the 1920s, Black women recorded hundreds and hundreds of blues songs. The 1920s was considered the era of the classic blues. It was the era during which women recorded songs about virtually anything you can imagine. In 1920, a woman by the name of Mamie Smith accidentally recorded a song, accidentally, because when the white woman who was supposed to be in the recording studio that day got sick, you know, she was invited to take her place. And this song sold. This record sold. And so the company was convinced to allow her to record a blues song, which she did, Crazy Blues. This blues song sold 75,000 copies. This record sold 75,000 copies within 1 month. And it was Black people who bought the record for a dollar a piece, which was a lot of money in those days. You know, more like what, $25, $30? But the point is, the record companies realized that they had this market, this untapped market, this unacknowledged market in Black communities. And therefore, they began to court all kinds of Black women blues singers to record the blues. So as a result of this sort of capitalist strategy that led to race records in virtually every existing recording company at that time. As a result of that, we have this marvelous collection of oral texts, we might say, that give us an idea of how poor people, poor women, poor black women were thinking about a whole range of subjects. And one of those subjects is sexuality. And I mention sexuality because it's always been such a taboo subject. It still is. And even as women like Ida Wells and Anna Julia Cooper and Mary Church Terrell and all of the women who were involved in the emergence of the Black Women's Club movement attempted to establish relationships with poor women that were based on the notion of lifting as we climb, there was not the ability to acknowledge the importance of the way poor women talked about sexuality. And it occurred to me in listening to these blues songs that there was a reason why so many of these songs have as their core theme love or sex or sexuality. There's some sexual theme that is the core theme of virtually every song. And it occurred to me that for a people who had been held in slavery and who for so long had been denied the right to make choices about the kinds of relationships they would enter into, about, you know, who they would share their lives with, that the abolition of slavery meant that they could make autonomous, independent decisions about matters of love or matters of sex, about who to enter into a sexual relationship with, whether it be a couple of days or, you know, a couple of weeks or a couple of years or for a lifetime. And this was quite radical, particularly since during slavery, in many instances, black people were literally mated with each other. That sexual desire was supposed to be subordinated to the economic goal of reproducing the slave population. And so in the aftermath of slavery, it must have been revolutionary to be able to think about making decisions about sexual partnerships that had never been possible before.
Angela Davis, giving a talk in 1998 in Santa Monica about her book, Blues, Legacies, and Black Feminism, Gertrude Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, and Billie Holiday. Angela Davis is Distinguished Professor Emerita of History of Consciousness and Feminist Studies at UC Santa Cruz. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.